Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, and welcome to Rated LGBT Radio. And as advertised, I am Rob Watson. Tonight we have probably one of the most incredible shows I think I've done. We have a man on who has been an icon for me and a hero, and I have been in complete and utter awe. And in full disclosure, before we did the show, I did a quick sound check with Brody and our guest, who is the Bishop retired Gene Robinson. And I sound checked Bishop Gene, and it's like I'm getting off going, oh my God, I just talked to Bishop Gene Robinson. I can't believe this. So I am completely fan perquimped. But we will get through this because we're going to talk about some serious stuff. And that serious stuff includes the fact that this week, LGBTQ icon Matthew Shepard was finally laid to rest. He has been in the possession of his parents for the last 20 years, who did not want his grave to be defiled, which is a really valid concern considering Westboro Baptist Church descended upon them immediately after his death and did everything they could to disrupt the memorial service at the time. And so they finally chose Washington, D.C.'s National Cathedral and selected Bishop Robinson to do the eulogy, which is, for me personally, is a little bit ironic in the sense that I think Bishop Robinson is another LGBTQ icon. And I'm already guessing he's wincing at that characterization, but I will explain it. He is an icon because when he rose to the position he did, churches literally ripped themselves apart over it. It was the biggest issue to hit the religious platform since, I think, almost when Martin Luther tacked, you know, his stuff onto the church doors. And he weathered that storm beautifully, gracefully, and inspiringly. And so it is going to be an incredible honor to talk to him, as well as hear his experience this week, and get his insight on the state of the country. Speaking of state of the country, I want to bring on my co-host, Brody Levesque. Brody, good evening.
Good evening, Rob, and good evening to all of our listeners. It's been a hell of a couple of weeks, no doubt.
Yeah, I didn't check with you beforehand, but do we have any other news stories we should talk about before we get into our main subject tonight?
Real briefly before we bring Bishop Gene on, President Trump today at the White House had a press conference in the West Wing, and he announced some new policies that the United States will be enacting towards migrants that are headed north through Central America. The Trump administration has ordered 5,000 plus troops to the border with Mexico. The Trump administration is considering adding approximately another 6,000 or 7,000 to that, which within combination of the National Guard already on the border would bring U.S. troop totals to right around 15,500, which ironically is more troops than currently stationed in either theater of war in Iraq or Afghanistan. One of the other things that, of course, has been extremely troubling, and this is just going back over this last 2 week period, that we had a gentleman shoot and kill two black folks in a Kroger's in Kentucky, and this was after he was turned away from a church. We had the bombing spree We, of course, had the mass shooting in Pittsburgh. And then over the weekend, the Republicans and the Trump people released probably one of the worst ads that has been put out there in 30 years, certainly on par with the Willie Horton ad that the Bush campaign ran against then-Governor Michael Dukakis during the 88 presidential race. And it accuses Democrats of plotting with people to get Central American, quote-unquote, invaders to overrun the nation with cop killers and MS-13 and all of these other things. I think the clarification needs to be made in the speech today, at least from this journalist's point of view, that the president of the United States basically not only misconstrued, but he lied throughout the entire speech. He characterizes this as an invasion. It's not even close. The other part of it is he said that they overpowered the Mexican military and Mexican troops, and that they weren't going to do that with our troops. And then the thing that he said that was probably the most alarming was that, as far as he was concerned, if they threw rocks or anything of that nature, sticks at American troops, those were to be treated as rifles. So essentially, the president of the United States just basically gave a license to the American military to shoot unarmed migrant civilians. Mind you, these are people that are fleeing just an absolute horrifying situation on the ground in Honduras, in Nicaragua, in El Salvador. So, you know, and the other part of it is that he said that, well, we're not going to do the catch and release anymore. We're going to keep them all. You know, we're going to keep them penned up and then we're going to deport them. These policies and this rhetoric that he's using is the same kind of rhetoric that we've seen out of this administration for the last 2 years. This is the type of rhetoric that has caused incidences like what we saw in Pittsburgh. Yeah, a lot of my colleagues in the press and a lot of other people say, well, it's not fair to blame the president of the United States. And I'm saying no. The presidency is a pulpit, if you will, and I'm almost sure Bishop Jean was cringing on my use of that term, but it's true. And the thing of it is that when you have someone like Trump, who, in my personal opinion and observation, is little more than a mafia don, a John Gotti, if you will, it does affect, because words have consequences, words matter, and words have meaning. And what this administration has done has been to exasperate racism and hatred and things that I think in many cases probably were there, but were working their way through the American culture and society. But he re-energized it, and his base re-energized it. And I was speaking with a dear friend of mine who Bishop Jean actually knows too, Sarah Grossman. She's the communications director for the Matthew Shepard Foundation in Denver. And Judy and Dennis at one point had wanted to close up shop. They realized now that, you know, the job is far from finished. So, and with that, I'll let you bring my friend Bishop Jean on. And we can go to work.
Well, and I have to say, I think your characterization of the president is right on target. And I also agree with you on the effect of his rhetoric. I'm sort of surprised, honestly, that anybody could take it any other way than what you described, because we have the facts. We have the facts of the increase of hate crime that has gone up through his influence. And so to minimize that effect seems to be just complete willful, ignorance. And I mean, so I'm underscoring and agreeing with you in a big way.
I think that there's no other way, quite frankly, to look at it. And unfortunately, as you know, and we've talked about on previous shows over the course of this presidency, particularly when in regard to Vice President Mike Pence, who is a Christian supremacist and a dominionist. Bishop Jean is a Christian. Mike Pence is a Christian supremacist, and there's a big difference in my mind. Bishop Gene may not agree with me, but that's just how I view it. And that has re-energized and reignited, particularly for our trans brothers and sisters, because they now find themselves at the tip of the sword. And it's extremely, extremely unfortunate.
I agree. And with that, so that because we've talked behind his back probably long enough, I do want to bring on and welcome to the show Bishop Gene Robinson. Bishop Robinson, welcome.
Rob, I'm so glad to speak to you, and I'm glad you've got Brody there to make sure you behave.
It's actually the other way around.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I'm delighted to be with you.
It is an incredible honor.
Well, all I'll say to that is you need to get out more.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I'm going to go look around in the street corner and find other individuals have risen to the top of their organized religions as LGBTQ. I have a feeling that will be a very short walk.
I think it might be.
Yeah. I have to say, I watched your, and I don't want to use this word disrespectfully, but your performance at Matthew Shepard's interment ceremony, I was so incredibly moved and touched. And I just have to thank you. I want to thank you for everything. I want to thank you for everything you've done, who you are, what you've barreled through, fought through, and to the point of this incredible internment, which you said yourself on the stage there, that you had actually been crying for a long time before you gave the eulogy you did. What was that like for you? What were the emotions leading up to and through that internment for you?
You know, I feel now that I'm 4 or 5 days after it, almost a week now, that in some ways my whole life prepared me for that particular moment. And I didn't know it would be so significant for me or that I would feel that deeply about it. When I knew that I would be preaching a homily at the interment service there at the National Cathedral, I was very moved by that and incredibly honored, and I just felt like it was going to be a special moment. And then on the Tuesday before the service on Friday, I found out that indeed I would be carrying Matt's ashes into the cathedral and out, and then down into the crypt to be buried. And when I found that out, I basically started sobbing and didn't stop until the service started 3 days later. It was just such a I felt like it was a responsibility and an honor. You know, Matt was an Episcopalian. The National Cathedral is an Episcopal cathedral. But it kind of serves the nation for state funerals and all of that kind of thing. But Matt was an Episcopalian, loved his church, and his local parish in Wyoming was actually very accepting of him and affirming and so on. And so one of the things that I think that Dennis and Judy Shepherd felt was that Matt would have loved being there. Right. But for me, and if you listen to the whole sermon, you'll know that I ended with this. It felt like bringing Matt home. And I guess if someone were to ask me what I thought about heaven, I would say, you know, we don't know much about that other than that the same God who has loved us from the very beginning will continue loving us beyond death, whatever that looks like. I don't need to know any more than that. But in some sense, it's a kind of coming home, right? And so I just, that image just stayed with me as I prepared. And so I was just overwhelmed by the honor of bearing his ashes down this long, long aisle of this magnificent cathedral, which was filled to capacity. Every seat was taken. There were people who had flown in the night before and were going to fly out that afternoon, but they wanted to be there. And I guess in some ways, I was surprised that Matt's memory was still so alive and so almost fresh in people's own memories. And it turned out to be that way for me as well. On Twitter, afterwards, someone said, had addressed a tweet to me saying, thank you for giving us the comfort that we didn't know we still needed. And I think it was the service was very much like that for people. They sort of got back in touch with why the story was so powerful. And I think at the end of the day, I'll end with this, and you can ask me more questions, but at the end of the day, I think the reason his story was so powerful for all of us and continues to be is that every gay or lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer person knows that it could have been them. It could have been me. It could have been you. It could have been any one of us. And our parents, any one of them, could have been Dennis and Judy Shepherd. And so it really is a way for our community to kind of crystallize the kind of violence that's been done against us since the beginning of time, but continues to this very day.
Yeah, I really relate to what you just said in terms of this personal impact with you, because it what happened with that internment was almost like a final chapter in almost a scriptural way. I mean, here we had somebody who was an LGBTQ martyr. And for me personally, when I saw the very first images 20 years ago, that's what I was witnessing for me was a crucifixion, and it was everything you just described, but almost that other additional level of intensity of this was an innocent crucified. And the story of you who went through a whole other religious path in terms of excelling in a church and literally having, you know, sort of a structured crucifixion, if you will, you know, organizationally and everything else, for you to be the one to take your personal hand and to lay him to rest in a crypt, to me is an incredibly intense, beautiful, perfect, bittersweet, inspiring end to this story. So I love the emotion and connection you had with it, because that made it all incredibly real. And Brody, I'll turn it over to you.
Let me just say that one of the images, of course, that we use to describe bishops is the image of a shepherd. And I felt like that last Friday at that service, I was not only a shepherd bringing Matt home, but a shepherd for the LGBTQ community. And that was an indescribable honor for me. I don't feel deserving, and I still, for the life of me, have never figured out why the person to make this kind of impact on the church turned out to be me. But it did turn out to be me, and I've tried to be as good a steward of that opportunity as possible. And it felt like last Friday that it was sort of my great reward was to be able to gather our community together and bury one of our own. It was just an indescribable honor.
On that note, 20 years ago, I not only covered the story itself on the ground, starting with the hospital in Fort Collins all the way through to the funeral at St. Mark's, but then I came back for the trial. And that was when I met Romaine Patterson and Jim Osborne. And as you know, Bishop Gene, those two came up with probably one of the most creative things I have ever seen in my life when they did the angel action, okay, which blocked the Westboro Baptist Church. So anyone going into the Albany County Courthouse could hear Freddie and Marjorie and Shirley and the rest of them making all that noise, but you couldn't see the garish neon signs or any of that. Jim and Romaine had gotten their friends and everyone had volunteered, including Kathy Renna, and they were dressed in these angel costumes. These things were massive, right? And I was inside the courthouse, and one of my other wire service guys said, "Buddy, you've got to come see this." And it was freezing that day. I'm not going to lie. It was one of the coldest Wyoming days possible. And unfortunately, Laramie is like right in the middle of a wind tunnel. So we're outside, and it just dead silence. Here all these people come wearing these angels costumes, and then they turn sideways, wingtip to wingtip. You can no longer see Freddie in the church. And all I could think to myself was, boy, is that ever fitting. So on that note, I have a personal message from my dear friend Jim Osborne, who I met 20 years ago, and we've kept in touch. And this is from Jim Osborne to you, Bishop Gene. Brody,
okay.
Brody, please give him thanks from an angel for such a beautiful service for Matt and so many years of courageous and heartfelt activism. Jim Osborne.
Oh, that's really wonderful. And, you know, in a crazy sort of way, he is an angel. And, you know, what I love about what they did is that that got repeated in a goodly number of places and circumstances where there was some kind of hate group trying to disrupt. And other groups around the country took that strategy and literally – defeated hate with love, right? And I just that is a symbol that just lives on and inspired so many other people. It was a great thing at the time. It continues to both amuse me and amaze me because it was such a brilliant strategy.
I think it was great. You know, one of the things, and of course, Rob is kind of a little bit at a disadvantage, so I'm going to let him have a little bit more time with you because you and I have known each other for a really long time. I remember a question I asked you that very cold day in March out on the steps. I was interviewing Rob Reiner, and that was during the whole thing with the first of the marriage when we had the first hearings on it, not the decision day,
right,
but the hearing day. And I think you and Evan had popped out and were coming around the corner, and I interrupted Rob, and he was, you know, going on and on and on. I said, I've got to go, Bishop Gene. he looked at me like I just lost my mind. I'm sorry, but yeah, you know, when it comes down to people who write, I know you're all famous Hollywood director, but guess what? But I had asked you that question, and the question that I'm going to say again tonight, because it seems really, here we are, what, 2-3 years out from that, and it's still applicable. Bishop Gene, you know, what is it going to take for us to convince the extremist fringe parts of the religious right, or even within the Christian community itself, that everybody needs to have a place at the table? I mean, I hate to sound like, you know, the the star that fell down from the heaven in the Chronicles of Narnia, you know, when she's talking about Aslan's table. But I think metaphorically, that's what I'm talking about. You know, and I asked you that question. I remember you looked at me and you said, that's a good question, Brody. And I think it's just going to be a combination of things. Well, Bishop Gene, here we are later. What combination of things do you think it's going to take?
You know, we didn't get here quickly, and we're not going to get out of this situation quickly. So I think the first thing is it's going to require patience and tenacity. I mean, we have to keep working at this day in, day out, 365 days a year, and we also need to be in this for the long haul, because changing hearts and minds is it's tough work. And it can't be done overnight. You know, some days I'm just really discouraged, but other days I look around and I think, wow, you know, I'm 71 years old. When I grew up, we couldn't have imagined we would live to see what we've seen, and because you can't, I mean, it was so unthinkable. Gay marriage? Are you crazy? Never mind the kind of acceptance that so many of us have found. So you know, I think we're making progress. I'll tell you what really to go back to some of the basics. You know, Harvey Milk always said, you know, you've got to come out, because until they know us, they won't have the chance to love us. And you know, he made it notoriously, he made his own staff call their parents and come out and all of that kind of stuff. But what we've seen, the progress we've seen, is mostly due to our coming out. And the families whose love for their children, I hate to even use this word, but trumps the whatever it is they've learned in church. And so we see the same kinds of things happening in churches. Now, the Roman Catholic hierarchy may still be teaching that we are intrinsically disordered. But the fact of the matter is, a majority of lay people in the Roman Catholic Church in this country are very positive about LGBTQ people. And that's because so many of them have children or grandchildren or nieces or nephews whom they know and love and are not going to stop loving just because they find out that they're LGBTQ. So you know, I think we are making progress. One of the interesting things, and I'll make a prediction here, which is always dangerous, but we know that extremely conservative Christian churches, which were growing for quite some time, are not growing. And in fact, they are hemorrhaging young people. And the number one reason that they give for leaving those churches is what the church teaches about LGBTQ people. And the reason is because they have friends who are LGBTQ. And they know that what they're being told about them is simply a lie. And I'm going to predict that if those churches want to have a future, they need their young people. And they're going to have a revelation sometime soon that is going to enable them to keep their best young people who are going to leave otherwise. Otherwise, they're going to die. And yeah. Survival has a way of getting your attention. And I think that's what we're looking at. And that may be the thing that really makes the biggest change in these religious institutions. You know, the mainline churches have come a long way, and you know, the Lutherans and the Presbyterians and the Methodists were all holding back literally to see if my election was going to destroy the Episcopal Church. Mm-hmm. And it was really hard. But at the end of the day, although the the headlines would have gotten you to believe that the split in the Episcopal Church was, you know, 50-50. In fact, only about 5% of Episcopalians thought it was worth leaving over. So we lost 100,000 people out of 2 million, which is not a small number, and I wish it had not happened. But it certainly wasn't the enormous split that the newspaper headlines would have convinced you of. And those other mainline denominations began their serious work when they saw we were going to survive it.
Yeah. Thank you for that perspective. That's really incredible. I want to take it kind of to the next level in kind of a follow-up. Bishop Robinson, I'm coming to it not only as an LGBTQ person, but as a Christian myself. And my gut wrench over the way things have played out, especially recently, especially in the last few years, because I agree with you on the progress we've made. And, you know, I'm old enough to be, you know, astounded by how far we've come and, you know, in a relatively short period of time. So I definitely get that from the LGBTQ perspective, but from the Christ perspective for me, everything that is being stood for under the banner of public Christianity today, and I probably shouldn't say everything because I realize the Episcopalian Church is out there and other progressive voices quietly in the background, while the people who are getting the reputation of being quote-unquote Christians are espousing things that are not only, you know, to Brody's point, not inviting everybody to the table, but to me, they are diametrically opposed to every single thing that I personally know to be of Christ. I mean, everything in Jesus' ministry, if you go down it, and not to pick on him, but I will, Donald Trump seems to be the exact opposite. Down from the rich man who cannot, get through the eye of a needle, to the beatitudes of being humble, to turning the other cheek, to the Good Samaritan, to, you know, just everything. It is completely, and I'm not using this term lightly, anti-Christ. And while I hear you on these organizations that are bleeding young people, I see the concept of Christianity itself being completely destroyed from inside of this implosion, and everything that Christ stood for being completely eradicated. How do we get that back? How do those of us who are not of that philosophy fight this back? Where is the march on Washington from progressive Christians, like the Women's March?
Yeah, and let's start by saying that one of the reasons that those people are known for their Christianity is that they own the airwaves, right? Those conservative, crazy, far-right Christians have radio stations, and they have multiple congregations. I mean, they are serious about getting their word out. And those of us who are progressive Christians are so worried that we will be mistaken for them, that somehow people will link us to them, that we keep our mouths shut. And so I think one of the remedies is for us to get a little less reticent to speak out as Christians. We've been hurt by those people, and we do not want to be associated with them because of just what you say. At the same time, if we keep silent, then we allow that version of Christianity to be the one that the world sees. So I think we have to get very much more upfront about why we have the values we do. I'll just also point out that you'll remember it was Jesus who went into the temple and overturned the money changers' tables, and the people he was the hardest on were the religious leaders of his day because they were not living up to the scriptures, which, of course, are the Hebrew scriptures, or what we sometimes, in a kind of condescending way, call the Old Testament. So, you know, it's been around a long time, people espousing one thing and doing another. And I just think it tends to be the way of the world. And I'm not sure that we can pass judgment on them, but I do think we need to be quite out front about what motivates us. And it was interesting. There were two accounts of the Matt Shepherd service from two sources that I would not in any way link to the religious world. One was Vox.com, Ezra Klein's operation, and the other was Slate.com. And both of them linked Matt's service and what I said in my homily to the work that William Barber has been doing in North Carolina and is now doing as part of the Poor People's Campaign, and felt that we are seeing the rise of the Christian left, the progressive Christian movement. And I think they may be right, and it's just so interesting that it was from a thoroughly secular position that was noticed. And so I think we do have to get very much more public about our faith, because if we don't, then we leave Christianity to those who would abuse it.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree.
Let me ask you something. I'll let you finish, Rob. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, no, I was just gonna say I am all on board to do some table turning in the temple. So I'm, you know, sign me up. Go ahead, Brody.
Well, and as Bishop Gene knows, I'm extremely secular. Well, Rob, you know that too. Sometimes Kathy Baldick
has to.
Yeah. No, thank you, Bishop Gene. Let's not go there. But I think that having, you know, interviewed and talked with Reverend Barber, and I actually did read those two pieces, Bishop Gene, I would tend to agree with that. One of the things that Kathy Baldick and I had talked about when I first met her for the very first time in the flesh, I took her to Frank Kameny's funeral services there at the Carnegie Library in Washington, and she immediately buttonholed Vince Gray afterwards, which it was kind of fun to watch the mayor of the city of Washington squirm. You know how Kathy is. But
right.
One of the things that Kathy asked me, and I'm going to put this to you. This was in Frank died in 2011, ironically on National Coming Out Day of all days. He had his timing. I'll give Frank that. But one of the things that Kathy and I talked about is she asked me directly. She said, Brody, what's the biggest thing? I said, the biggest problem is that the uber right, the Christian supremacists, the Christian fascists is what I call them, the crystal fascists, they've hijacked your religion and they've weaponized it. And unless you guys are able to convince mom, pop, apple pie, Chevrolet, and Walmart customer, okay, that these folks are, you know, scaring their money out of granny and whatever else for doom and gloom, and none of it's true, you know, you guys are going to continue to have a promise. And one of the reasons that the right is always so successful is because they know how to stab each other in the back, smile pretty, okay, and then stay on message and walk, you know, goose step it down the street. You know, the problem with the left has always been it's like parading, you know, cats in a parade. But now that was in 2011, Bishop Gene. Right now, all of these shootings, all of this hate, and I'm going to put the blame at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. I don't care if my colleagues get annoyed at me and I get the, you know, emails and the texts tomorrow. I see this as a reflection, okay, of a larger sense. You know, Trump isn't necessarily the disease. I think he's more the symptom. And I think that the other part of it is that unless people are able to communicate with each other, and this is what I told Kathy back in 2011, you know, look at what we've got right now, Bishop Gene. I mean, seriously, there's got to be a way where there could be more effective communication, not just only from, you know, secular people like myself who are also journalists, but, you know, folks like Rob who are Christian LGBT or you yourself or others. You know, what is it going to take to get the effective messaging out there so that mom, pop, apple pie, Chevrolet, and the Walmart customer doesn't continuously see us as the boogeyman? And then before I let you answer that, I'm going to throw one thing into the mix here. And this is because I've been a trans ally for over 35 years now. And, of course, as you know, I'm friends with Sarah. And you, of course, married Sarah and Andrew. You know, they're always, you know, it's always a combination, you know, of a twisted theology. I've never been able to find anything about gender identity in your Christian Bible. And trust me, I've looked. But it seems to be the ick factor with them. And then they kind of pull these obscure passages and use that as weapons. So it's that and then getting mom, pop, apple pie, and the Chevrolet and the Walmart customers see it, just like I told Kathy back in 2011. What do you think? So, I mean, where are you at with this?
Well, so a couple of things. One is I think there is a natural reluctance because we get so much pushback when we do it, to link religion and politics. And you know, you don't have to do much in the sermon to have parishioners saying, oh, I don't come here for that. You know, I come here to get away from the politics. You know, and my response to that always is, Jesus was not killed because he preached love thy neighbor. He was preached because he was a political threat to the Roman Empire and could have led an army and an insurrection and so on. And so he was crucified the way they treated every other insurrectionist, right? So Christians claim to follow a guy who was all political all the time. And so if we are going to be followers, then we have to be involved in this political stuff as well and not be ashamed of it and not sort of tiptoe around about it. And I think that's exactly what William Barber is doing. And I will also say other leaders of other faiths. We have Jews and Muslims and Sikhs and Hindus and Buddhists and humanists all calling us to better and higher values. It's not, you know, Christians don't have a monopoly on goodness and on moral living. So I think that's part of it, is that we have to be comfortable with linking these two things. It was not lost on me that Matt's, not funeral, but his interment, was sandwiched between the bombings and the massacre in Pittsburgh. And it's a reminder to me, at least, that these sentiments didn't go away. They just went underground. And I think that the president's role in this is through the so-called bird whistles or dog whistles and then his just outright comments, I think gives permission for people who have been feeling those kind of hateful things for a long time. They feel emboldened to speak them out loud and to act them out in their lives. So I don't think it's something new. I just think it's something that has surfaced that has been pushed underground for a while, and I think we've just got to take that incredibly seriously, and stand against it, and stand against anyone who would say or do anything that gives any kind of legitimacy to those kinds of feelings and political political aspirations and so on in a country that known for welcoming all, right? So,
mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be a multi-faced struggle. It always has been. There is no one magic bullet that's going to solve it. But I do think, one of the things that I said at that at the service last Friday was, if you just came here to mourn and grieve for Matt and to do him honor as he's laid to rest, then you know what? That's not enough. You need to have come here to be transformed and to be set loose on the world for good. And I think we just need to call on one another that, sitting quietly on the sidelines while we have a president who does what this president is doing and mm-hmm. and contributes to an atmosphere where Pittsburgh can happen and where the bombings can happen. It's just no longer okay to sit on the sidelines and say, gosh, you know what, I'm kind of a private person. I can't do anything about that. Good Lord, we can't even get more than 50% of the people to vote in this country. So I just think there's all kinds of things that we need to be doing to move us forward. Because the last 2 years, we have taken some serious step backwards.
Yeah, definitely.
I want to ask you, Bishop Robinson, there's an article that Kathy Renna just put out called What to Do About Hate in America. And with that title, I'm sure you're going to guess where my question is going to go. But when the point she made in the article, one of the key points was how on both sides of the conversation right now, everybody is baying people. It's, everybody's going into a they group, they this, they that, and then a bunch of qualities are ascribed to the theys, most of which on all sides are not accurate. And the hate and anger is building and building and building. For my personal philosophy, the antidote to hate has always been love. The antidote to fear has always been love. What is your perspective on the application of divine love, the more powerful form of love, on this, and how do we get in touch with it?
So I think you pointed right at the answer that I would give when you used the word powerful. So I think we have a gooey-eyed, a misty, floating in the middle of the air, a sentimental version of what love is. And I think we need to start thinking of love as being tough and confrontative and in your face when need be, and not. I think we think of love as being incredibly passive and just sort of letting the world go by or not confronting injustice and so on. And I don't see anything in the scriptures, either in the Hebrew scriptures or the Christian scriptures, that advocate that kind of arm's length love. The Christian story is that God loved us enough and wanted to love us more deeply and became incarnate in this Galilean rabbi, and that was not a passive sitting back. That was a really active thing and stirred the waters and caused a lot of trouble and got killed for it. And I just think we need to do that. I can remember, I got my first death threat on the day that I was elected bishop, before I even got home, and that's a 9-mile drive, and, you know, mostly daily death threats for, I don't know, two and a half years. And I can remember my partner and I, this was about the time the abortion doctor was shot through his kitchen window in, I think it was Syracuse or maybe Rochester, New York. And we lived in a wooden glass contemporary house, and you know, we could have been shot through in almost any room of that house. And we were deciding whether or not we should go out and buy bed sheets and cover all the windows because we didn't have any curtains. And we just decided that if the threats made us do that and made us change our lives, then they won. And I think we need to just resolve in our own minds that we're going to pay whatever the cost is to do the right thing, to change the world for better. And if that risks our reputation, if it risks us, you know, financially, if it even risks our lives, I think at some point we have to choose that. It's an interesting thing. Jesus says, I picked up my own cross. I picked up this burden. No one made me do it. I chose it. And I think in small ways and in large ways, each one of us has to decide what piece of this burden are we going to carry and what price are we willing to pay?
Bishop Gene, let me ask you this, and this is for, and we have young folks that listen to the show, and, mm-hmm. You know, the most important, I think, aspect to a lot of the conversation that we're having this evening and the conversation that was really started years ago was carried through with the homily you gave at the National Cathedral, and this continues to be the messaging, but it's the young people that are coming up. For them, on the one hand, they're extremely fortunate because those of us that were ahead of them kind of paved the way, if you will. And Matt, in his own right, with his tragic death, and then, you know, Matt's legacy, obviously, is Dennis, Judy, and Logan, and what they did with the foundation and all this work so that these young people can at least, you know, be out a lot more openly than we ever could at our ages. But if you've got a young person right now, okay, and they're just not certain, and they're listening to us, what's the message to them? Because they may be in Oklahoma, they could be in Texas, they could be in Alabama, they could even be in New York or your own home state of New Hampshire, in a place where
affirming. One of the problems I think in our community right now is that if you are on one of the two coasts or you live in an urban area, the chances are pretty good that your life as an LGBTQ person is you know, reasonably good. And once we got gay marriage, then, you know, a lot of the people who funded our movement were sitting pretty. And it's hard to convince those people that much of the United States is no different than it was when Matt Shepard was growing up or when I was growing up or when you were growing up. And so, first of all, the work is not done. We have accomplished a lot. But in some 30 states, you can still be fired from your job just for being gay. Nobody believes that. They think once we got married, we were set, and we simply are not. And if you're two lesbians, you're African-American lesbians raising two or three children at or below the poverty level in Mississippi, gay marriage doesn't mean all that much to you, but mm-hmm. keeping your job does. So first of all, if you're a young LGBTQ person, there is a lot still to be done for our own community. But then I want to say another thing, which is often people will ask me because they're tired from all the work and they'll say to me like, so Bishop, when is all this going to be over? And what I say to them is, you know what, I don't have a lot of good news for you, because as soon as this is over, as soon as we we value LGBTQ people the way we value other people. God is going to point out somebody else that we forgot, that we've been overlooking or mistreating or whatever. And then there will be another fight to fight. And so we have to get used to doing this justice work as a way of living. We're never going to get it done and check it off our to-do list and sit down in a rocking chair, because there's always going to be more justice work to be done until, in fact, we create heaven here on earth. And so I would say to them, if you're not interested in particularly doing LGBTQ work, look around. There are other people who are being unjustly treated. Get involved in the criminal justice system. Get involved in restorative justice work, where instead of sending young men off to prison, usually young black and Hispanic men off to prison mostly, there are other ways of treating those people, making them responsible for what they've done, but not incarcerating them for the rest of their lives. So there's justice work to do wherever you are, whether it be the continued LGBTQ work that we need to do, or someone else that needs our care and our advocacy.
Agreed.
Well, with
Agreed.
That, yeah, with that, we are out of time. I can't believe it. This hour has literally flown by. Bishop Gene, I want to thank you so incredibly deeply for coming on with us tonight. This has been an absolute dream and an absolute inspiration. You've left me speechless a few times in this hour, and I have to tell you, for a radio host, that's kind of a liability. But it was all a good thing.
As you can tell, I'm rarely speechless. So there you go.
A total
joy to be with you. Thank you so much. And just say hello to the community out there, and let's all keep working.
Yes, definitely.
Thanks.
And Brody, I want to thank you as always, your incredible work here on this show and what you do every day to literally save our country. I want to thank our listeners for tuning in. We will be back here again next week, same bat channel, same bat time, with another really super important show. So tune in. Also, don't forget, out in Santa Cruz, Saturday night at 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time, and you can listen to that on www.kfco.com. That's another hour of LGBT news and cultural information. And with that, I want to thank again our esteemed guest, not only for his participation tonight, but this is a man who has made a huge impact on who we are, on our culture, on our religion, and everything else, and it is truly, truly, truly a blessing. So with that, I will bid everyone good night.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio!